Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio 89.1, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I am your host for today, Susan Franzen, together with my co-host, Ursula Rudenberg. Hello, Ursula.
Hello, Susan, and hello to all listeners. Susan, do you have a weather report?
Yes, I do. Mostly sunny with high near 52 today. West-northwest wind 7 to 9 miles per hour. Tonight, mostly cloudy with a low around 34. Northeast wind 5 to 7 miles per hour. And Tuesday, a chance of rain before 1 p.m. The rain may turn to snow, high near 40. Breezy with a north-northwest wind 10 to 20 miles per hour with gusts as high as 28 miles per hour. Chance of precipitation is 90%. New snow accumulation of 1 to 2 inches possible. Tuesday night, rain and snow before 7 p.m., then a chance of snow between 7 p.m. and 1 a.m. Low around 22, blustery, with a north wind 15 to 20 miles per hour, gusts as high as 28. Chance of precipitation is 80%. New snow accumulation of less than 1 inch possible. Wednesday, partly sunny with a high near 32. North-northwest wind around 14 miles per hour with gusts as high as 18.
Thank you, Susan. I guess we can enjoy the warmer weather while we can. It doesn't look like it's going to last. One of the things that I think all of us have noticed in the last week is one of the significant changes has been that the robins are back. Everywhere you go, there's robins.
And in spite of the weather, they seem to be singing and shivering in the snow.
Well, it's funny because usually, you know, you notice robins, they're very lively and they're running around and they're doing things. And last week, I kept noticing that you just saw them sitting around everywhere like puffballs, kind of just staring at the snow and looking like they were just sitting there in stunned perplexedness. So anyway, Patch Larbaum is reporting on the robins today in our phenology report.
Phenology is the recording of nature's happenings when they occur. The first woodland hepatica blooming in the spring or the last osprey of autumn are noted in a journal for future reference. Today's focus on phenology is the return in mass of our American robins. Although our winter is lingering, the appearance of robins is a sight to behold. They return in March and are subjected to the varying weather patterns of late winter. Their presence is a positive sign that surely winter snows will be leaving us soon. Robins, like all of nature, honors our sun. It is the photoperiod or day length this time of year that triggers the robins' behavior to move north together. There's protection from predators provided when they flock up. Returning to their familiar territories from previous years is important to the robins, regardless of snow cover. Their return this spring has provided images of robins huddled together with feathers fluffed out like a down parka to provide additional air spaces for insulation. They appear hunkered down and seemingly waiting out the last stretches of winter. Their cheery spring sonatas will commence when warmer weather prevails any day now. Although robins are considered harbingers of spring, some American robins spend the whole winter in their breeding range here in Iowa. Before thawing and greening up, resident robins and early migrants back to Iowa are committed to surviving upon whatever they might discover to eat. In late winter, this means dried fruits like crab apples and sumac, service berries and choke cherries, hawthorn, dogwood, ninebark, and even poison ivy and juniper berries provide survival ration until the springtime commences. When they eat honeysuckle berries exclusively, they sometimes become intoxicated. And robins spread the seeds of berries, contributing to the dispersal of many plants. This is good for native shrubs and not so good with invasive species like honeysuckle. American robins are one of the most familiar and best known of our native songbirds. Nesting in close proximity to our homes and homesteads, robins seem to have adapted to humankind in the Iowa landscape. Though they're familiar town and city birds, American robins are at home in wilder areas too, including our forest preserves around the state. However, this has not always been the case. In the 19th century, John James Audubon and R.M. Anderson recorded that robins were nowhere very common in Iowa. As Iowa was settled, robins seem to have been one of the species that have benefited from human population expansion and habitat conversion that has been experienced since Euro-American settlement. Then in the 1950s and 60s, robins were included in the species that came under insidious attack and were facing extinction due to DDT. The use of this persistent organochloride insecticide was widespread to control everything from mosquitoes to Dutch elm disease, or seemingly anything that flew or crawled. Since its ban in 1972, many afflicted songbird populations are now recovering. Nesting for robins may start in early April, with a peak in late April and early May for their first nest. Robins usually nest a second and occasionally stretch a third nesting attempt into June and even July. Nests are located in forks of trees or ledges in outbuildings, garages, or atop eaves troughs. The deep cup of grasses, string, or strips of cloth worked into wet or soft mud makes up their nest. The female carries mud in her bill, then a lining of soft grasses is added. She incubates her robin's egg blue eggs for 12 to 14 days. Adult robins are very studious at providing nourishment to their young. Earthworms and beetle larvae are prime food sources. Mulberry seeds provide a very plentiful food source. One study suggests that robins may try to round out their diet by selectively eating fruits that have worms in them. The young fledge or fly from their nest by their third week, but only 25% of young survive to November. From that point on, about half of the robins alive in any year will make it to the next. Despite the fact that a robin can live up to 14 years, the entire population turns over on average every 6 years. In summer, females sleep at their nests and males gather at roosts in dense, shrubby areas. They group together in defense of predators. According to studies on the ISU campus, the main causes of predation were thought to be American crows, common grackles, and raccoons. As young robins become independent, they join the males. Females go to the roost sites only after they have finished nesting for the year. Robins flock together in late summer. Most leave during migration in October, but some linger. In winter, they favor river bottoms and other protected areas where a subsistence supply of berries can be foraged. The highest frequencies of robins on Christmas bird counts are from urban areas, southern Iowa, and along the Mississippi River. Robins are members of the thrush family of birds that include wood thrushes, solitaires, and bluebirds. And robins are the largest of North American thrushes. Their pot-bellied and authoritarian profile with elevated bill offers a good chance to learn the basic shape of most thrushes. And robins provide a good reference point for comparing their size and shape when describing other birds, such as the small hawk-like bird was slightly larger than a robin, and from that description I think it was an American kestrel. Sometimes wildlife work is dedicated to the rejuvenation of a once-endangered species. Or conservation work can be as simple as to keep our common species common to ensure future generations can benefit from their guidance. As Dr. Steve Dinsmore relates, American robins have adapted well to the habitat changes in Iowa over the past century. Their tolerance of humans and use of a variety of nest sites indicate they will remain one of the most familiar breeding birds in Iowa. The DNR State Forest Nursery has songbird packets available again this spring for those interested in planting trees and shrubs that benefit robins and all songbirds. This year's offering includes a white pine, bur oak, choke cherry, gray dogwood, serviceberry, and wild plums, and can be located at dnrsongbirdpacket.com. Place your order while supplies still last at dnrsongbirdpacket.com. Your songbird community will love you for it. And that's our American Robin Focus on Phenology for today. You're listening to KHOY Community Radio, 89.1 FM, Story City, Ames.
Thank you, Pat. Now, you've given our station ID, so we can talk about what's coming next. Later in the program, we'll devote some time to talking about medical marijuana.
The topic has come to Iowa.
Yes, it's being considered in the Iowa legislature this session. But first, let's spend a few moments looking at a very unusual proposal that was made to the Ames City Council this past week on March 4th. That proposal included construction of a dinosaur park in Ames.
Which has generated some interest and comments.
Yes, and from some surprising places. I happened to be at the Emergency Residence Project on Tuesday evening when the council was discussing this. Vic Moss, the director of the homeless shelter, mentioned that he'd read in the Tribune that there might be a dinosaur park. And a very lively discussion ensued among a number of people currently living at the shelter. There was a lot of discussion about places where folks had seen dinosaurs, including a man who remembered going to the Smithsonian, and several had seen the movie Night at the Museum. I'd say this is a topic with general appeal.
It's a surprising proposal here in Ames.
Which is why we decided to mention it. City Manager Steve Shanker is out of town today, but he gave me an interview on Friday to explain some of the basic information. Here's what he had to say.
Well, as the case in so many instances, many times developers in the city, in the state, or throughout the country come to us, the city officials or Economic Development Commission, and they want to talk about potential projects in our community. I think it's good that people are interested in us. I think our economy is so strong right now that people are looking to invest their money in the city. So we were actually approached by this developer, Mr. Warner, out of Kansas City, who approached us about building this multi-purpose development, about a $48 million development.
Apparently this was quite recently that he came to you.
Oh, we've been talking to him for a couple of months on and off, but I think he started to solidify his ideas for the project more recently. And what made it more challenging is to accomplish his project, he wants to take advantage of a new economic development program that's available in the state. It was actually a legislation that was passed late in the legislative session last year. And believe it or not, the rules and the application forms weren't developed until the end of the calendar year, so not until December. And what they found out was that the applications had to be in by March 15th. So a lot of people were interested and had to really start scrambling and getting their information solidified for the application. So it was only the last couple of weeks where we really started working in earnest to talk about specifics about the project and, more importantly, how we could get his application in on time.
How did he decide on the dinosaur park?
That's something you'll have to ask. We didn't dictate what was going to be in the project. He's come to us. And we know that what he described, which is a hotel, a Menards, a restaurant, and even a dinosaur park, are allowed in the area he was seeking to site the project along Southeast 16th Street. It's what is currently zoned, I believe, highway-oriented commercial. So we would advise him if he was trying to put it in the right area. In other words, council policy is that that is appropriate for the uses he's described. But he has actually selected all those particular uses, not the city of Ames.
From what I read in the newspaper article and from listening to the council hearings, it sounded as if his main motivation was to get the $14 million grant. That was one of the reasons why he's applying at this time. What would have happened if the grant hadn't been available? Would any of these things been suitable for that property?
Yes, the funding of it has nothing to do with the legality of the use. If it's properly zoned, it can be utilized regardless of where the developer gets the funding from. So even if they don't get the grant, those could happen, at least from a land use standpoint. Now, whether he can put together enough financing to make it happen without the grant is for something he'd have to answer.
Well, I was wondering, for example, about the Menards.
Yes.
I think there are a lot of people in Ames who would like to see a Menards. If Menards decided they wanted to put a store there, could they do it? Is there any reason why they couldn't?
No, like I said, anything that is allowed in the HOC, and Menards would be one, the highway-oriented commercial, could come separately or they could combine with other projects, as this is the case.
Well, it's pretty clear that the dinosaur park is to enhance the appeal to the grantors, making us a destination for tourism, for example.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. If you look at the scoring of the grant program, 25% deals with the uniqueness of the project itself, and they're looking for attractions that are unique. So I think you asked me why they picked a dinosaur park. I don't know why they picked a dinosaur park. I do know why they probably added an attraction into the mix, and that's because they would probably have a greater likelihood of getting or receiving the 25 out of the 100 points for that. There could be other attractions that are unique to Central Iowa they could have chosen, too. So I can't tell you why he picked the dinosaur park per se. He probably has some familiarity with the owner of the one in New Jersey. Maybe that's why. Mm-hmm. But certainly people can't just go out and put a Menards there and get this particular state grant. Probably can't even just put a motel or a hotel out there by itself. So it's a combination, if you look at the point scoring, that I think he's looking for.
Okay. Well, I was quite interested in the Field Station Dinosaur Park. It was obviously something that was very specific. And, yes, it would be certainly unique in the Middle West. But as Matthew Hill said, it is a rather strange thing to have in Iowa. There was discussion of that at the city council, I guess, a little bit. Mm-hmm. Amber Corrieri said that people in the audience questioned it. So that's how it came about. And one of the things that interested me in the council discussion was that Tim Garten actually talked quite a bit about the questions that he'd gotten from people about being in a floodplain. The concept of having a moratorium on building there, obviously we can't remove the things we've already put there, but the fact that everything that we add, every concrete slab that is put down, reduces the amount of water that can be absorbed.
I think you're talking about impervious land and such. This area is flooded by river water, and the volume of water is so much, I don't think it has anything to do with the amount of concrete. Whether it's concrete there or not, it's river flooding now. So it's a little different issue than I think you may be talking about. Still could be a question, a legitimate question to raise, why you want to build in an area that's flood prone, because it definitely is. But even if we had no concrete at all, if it was you had all sorts of grasses, I guarantee you that area would flood. I've seen it flood without development in it. Well, the city council policy now in those areas, that as long as you build it up 3 feet above the projected 100-year flood, they will allow development to occur. That's the policy of the city council.
I inferred that there might be a difference between the policy of the city council and what might be wise in the future, given the floods that we've had in the last 25 years and the prospects for greater floods if we don't get the upstream and downstream, well, particularly the upstream for us, water is taken care of.
In the very long, long term, it's working with a group that's working north with north of Ames. That's a long-term policy on how you handle cropland and grow, certain landscaping up there. And that's something that will take years to accomplish. In the short run, and when I mean the short run, maybe the next 10 years, the council is looking to maybe reshape the banks of the Squaw Creek to help facilitate water movement quicker, so you get the water out of Ames quicker, and also look to the state to widen that Highway 30 bridge. That is actually causes a constraint that backs water up into Ames. So those are kind of the two, I'll call them short range, but they're really probably 10 years out to take care of it. The long range, as you said, is to work farther up north, north of Ames, in the Story County.
Well, I guess that takes care of the two big issues that I had questions about. Is there anything that you believe the people of Ames might like to know that I have neglected to ask you?
Well, I think I want to emphasize all the council has done to date is authorize a pre-application. The way I understand the process, it's probably going to be two parts. There'll be pre-applications submitted by interested cities. And by the way, to qualify, the way the legislation is, the city has to apply, not the developer. That's how we became involved. But after the pre-application, I believe the state is going to have a committee that's going to prioritize and score these. And then certain projects, I'll call it a finalist group, will be selected. But even then, it's not a foregone conclusion the project will move ahead. The state may need more information before they finalize their commitment. And certainly the city will have to get more information, too. We're going to have to enter into a developer's agreement. So even though there are no city incentives going into it, there's state incentives, which we all pay for, but they're not city government incentives, we can, as part of our agreement to receive those funds, ask for certain things from the developer. If you notice, Matthew Goodman, are you watching that, asked for at least 3 things to be considered before he finalized it. There's talk about that dinosaur camp being nonprofit and things like that. I think Matthew made it clear that he wanted to make sure that it was a for-profit operation, therefore it will pay taxes to the citizens of Ames, That hasn't been finalized, but that's something we'd have to negotiate. He was concerned about flooding there, and if there's anything, and I don't know if there is, working with their engineers, we can help mitigate or at least not exacerbate the problem for flooding because of it. So we'll have to think about that. We haven't even started looking at the design of it. We haven't reviewed it with our staff about streets and stormwater runoff, all those things. That'll have to be to make sure that they commit to. So there are a number of items that have to be, developed to the satisfaction of the city council before they even would move ahead with it, even if the state okays it. Okay. So think of it as we're just trying to get into the front door, if you will, beating the deadline to make sure we're qualified. But there's a lot of discussions I'm sure the state will have about the project, and we will too, before anybody commits to anything.
Well, thank you very much. I'm very grateful to Steve Shanker for being here today with us.
This is Local Talk on radio station KHOI, and we've been listening to City Manager Steve Shanker explain why the City Council was considering development, including a Menards Hotel, Restaurant, and Dinosaur Park.
Susan, to recap what you and Steve were just speaking about, can you explain again what you know about the dinosaur park that's being proposed?
Developer Rick Warner of Oppenheimer in Kansas City has been in negotiation with the dinosaur park in New Jersey. It would be Field Station Dinosaurs, and if you look it up online, you'll see that it involves a trail with life-size dinosaurs which move and appear to come to life. There are also workshops, educational games, and activities. For the dinosaur park to move forward, state approval is the next step at this point. Financial help from the state would be for developing transformative projects that will improve the quality of life, create and enhance unique opportunities, and substantially benefit the community, region, and state. Ames is keeping the door open to future negotiations. However, the city remains protected from obligations to offer any financial incentives over and above what would come from the state. Furthermore, Matthew Goodman introduced stipulations to assure that flood control would be a major consideration and that the city would get maximum sales tax revenue.
By the way, Susan, have dinosaur remains actually been found in Iowa?
No. I guess we could research the topic of Iowa and dinosaurs for another local talk show, although Matthew Hill said at the hearing, Iowa was an ocean at the time of the dinosaurs, that we don't have any bones. So this is a little problem, I think, for the concept.
So for now, let's just see what happens.
I guess so.
And let's take a music break while we call Mary LaFrance to tell us how she supports legalizing medical marijuana.
Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio 89.1, where we explore the people's stories and events in central Iowa. I am Susan Franz, and your host for today, together with my co-host Ursula Rudenberg.
Earlier today, we had an interview with Ames City Manager Steve Shanker about the proposed development of a dinosaur park. Susan was asking him about the preliminary actions that have been taken to possibly apply for state money to help pay for the financing of such a development.
Now we turn to an issue of great importance to many people in Iowa, medical marijuana. For the balance of this program, we'll have a discussion with Marie LaFrance, who became an advocate for legalization of medical marijuana because her son has a serious epilepsy. I think it's best if she tells her own story. Marie, we're happy to have you with us today.
Thank you very much.
Would you please introduce yourself a little bit and tell, as the Iowa legislature is considering the legalization of medical marijuana, the stories of people like you become increasingly important. Could you tell us what your family situation is and why you have become an advocate for legalization?
Well, I have a small business in Iowa in real estate, and my husband is a coach at Drake University. And 12 years ago, we had a baby boy together, and his name is Quincy. And Quincy started having seizures at 5 months of age. And we went into a desperate spiral to try to control the seizures. And it seems that each time we tried a new medication, it would either make him worse or he would have the side effects, even the rarest of side effects. He would have that bad luck that he would get that side effect. And so we continued to try to stop the seizures. And 12 years later, our son is still seizing, and he's had horrible, horrible consequences from the prescription drugs that he's had, to the point now he is nonverbal, and he can't function very well on his own. We have to dress him, feed him. He can't even walk on his own right now, and we're hoping that that is a side effect of one of the medications he's currently on, because before we started that drug about 2.5 years ago, he was walking independently. So some of these medications will make a person very, very dizzy, and these are anti-epileptic medications, and nobody knows exactly how they work in the brain. Even the people that develop the medications aren't 100% sure. So they're very, very dangerous, mind-altering drugs that will work for many people with seizures. And neurologists have usually 3 or 4 standard anti-epileptic drugs that they will prescribe. And then if those don't work, I think that by the third drug, if it fails, the odds of an anti-epileptic drug working become very, very low.
Marie, this is Ursula Rudenberg. I'm here with Susan Franson, and Marie is joining us by telephone from Des Moines. Hi. Could you tell us how you discovered that marijuana might be an effective way to treat Quincy's epilepsy?
Yes, Ursula. It was August 3rd, actually, of last year, 2013, and I was going about my normal life, and several friends and family members had forwarded me a CNN.com article, and it said something about mom gives marijuana for epileptic daughter. And I thought, okay, that's ridiculous. I went about my day and kind of ignored it. And then maybe that night or the next morning, I decided, all right, you know, maybe if one person had emailed me that article, I might have ignored it. And since so many people, including my father, had emailed me that, I decided I better read that. And you know, I read that article and was just blown away. And immediately I started doing research, and I actually called the mom in the article, and she graciously called me back. I think I was sobbing the entire time, and I said, how do I get my hands on this? I need this. And so I called my neurologist right away and said, my son needs cannabis oil. So what happened in that article was it was describing how this mother, her husband worked in Pakistan and Afghanistan as a military contractor, and her daughter had actually the same diagnosis, epilepsy diagnosis, as my son. He spent a lot of time online since he was overseas, and in Israel, they use marijuana, what I like to call cannabis, that's been legal there since the 1970s. So Israel has been a research leader for medicine using cannabis, and so they make cannabis into an oil, also into a tea, and they can put the oil into capsules, and they give it to patients. And, you know, it's very common for a retirement home to have cannabis vaporizers in every single room. So because they know that it helps senior citizens, they're doing Alzheimer's research, all sorts of things. So this dad had emailed the mom in the article and, you know, told her, you got to try this. And so she lived in Colorado. And so she hunted around and found some cannabis and cooked it in oil and basically experimented until she found what worked for her daughter. And her daughter was having something like 300 seizures a week and went to less than one seizure a week. So it was just remarkable. And she started developing and started to talk again and do the things that she used to do before the seizures became so severe. What mom doesn't want that for their child, right?
Can you describe a little bit what you do as an advocate for this now? What action did you take after you discovered this?
Sure. So this was back in August, and I just thought, oh my goodness. This whole time, I just thought marijuana was a thing like alcohol, and I wasn't really following what was going on in other states. I knew that there was medical marijuana allowed, but I thought that people just found some reason that, you know, I thought that was a way of decriminalizing. I didn't realize that it was actually medicine. And so I thought, how do we get the word out to people? And so I had emailed all of the news, the Des Moines Register, I'm in Des Moines, so I'd contacted all of the Des Moines news agencies, and none of them got back to me. So then I thought, well, what do I do? How do I get the word out to people? So I made my own YouTube video, and it's called Legalized Medical Marijuana Iowa. And, you know, I think that has maybe 1,500 views by now, but it wasn't making your own news is very difficult, I've discovered, you know, getting a followership. But I made a video that described cannabis and how it works and how it is medicine and how Iowans deserve to have this. And then I called, you know, I looked around to see, okay, what else is going on in Iowa? What are other people doing in Iowa? And then I learned that there is a senator from Iowa City named Senator Joe Bolcom, and he has been introducing a cannabis bill for maybe a decade. And it either gets introduced in the House or the Senate, and it just sort of dies in committee. So I called him and emailed him and sent him my video. And, you know, he immediately graciously reached back out to me and explained what was going on and said how I can help him. And we kind of connected that way. So I have been speaking at some events in the fall that he had organized. I came and spoke, and there was a gentleman in a wheelchair. There was also a PTSD veteran, an Iraqi war veteran. And so we were speaking about our needs for medical cannabis. And the veteran, his story is almost more compelling than mine. His life was upside down after witnessing just unspeakable horrors in Iraq. And he came back and ended up, you know, turning to alcohol, like a lot of veterans do, and basically eventually checked himself into the VA, where they pumped him up with lots of anti-anxiety meds, which only made him worse, and he had really awful side effects. And he was in the VA hospital for 3 months and checked himself out after not seeing much improvement. And then some other veteran said to him, you know, you should really use pot. And so he tried cannabis and eventually was able to get his life back together and enroll back in college. And he has a daughter, and he was able to be a father to her. And, you know, so it's sort of a success story using cannabis, except that he's terrified he'll get caught too. And so he came and presented to some of these presentations that Senator Bolcom had lined up. But then I think eventually became too concerned that he would get caught and decided to just move. So he's planning on moving to Colorado.
I take it that's not an option for you.
It would be a devastating option because, you know, when you have a special needs child, you basically have to change your entire life to take care of them. So I had a different career when Quincy was born, and we've just changed everything around. So I've started a small business here in Iowa, and I would either need to sell that business or just abandon it. And that's not even as important as the support group that we have. Quincy's school system, they're just phenomenal. And I think they know him just almost about as well as any of our family members do. And they know exactly what his needs are. They can tell if he's having a good day or if he might be going into a seizure. They're so wonderful. And likewise, our friends. And then we have some caregivers. And so if we were to move, we would have to start all over. And once you have that established support system in place for, you know, we have somebody that comes and watches him once a week so that we could go on a date. And, you know, we would lose all of that support system. And we have such amazing friends. I think that we would eventually make new friends if we had to move. It would be years of loneliness, I think.
Now, are your friends supportive of your campaign for legalization of medical marijuana?
Oh, yes. In fact, I think several of them, you know, one of them even called me in the fall, and she's like, all right, I'm meeting my sisters for a reunion in Colorado. I'm going to bring you back some pot. You know, I've had several friends, you know, pledge to me that they will get me whatever I need, which is really, really, really sweet, except that, you know, the kind that Quincy needs is probably more along the lines of hemp, and it's very difficult to get your hands on certain strains that are good for children. There are plenty of strains out there that are good for epileptic adults right now, but given that Quincy is 12, you know, I mean, and for all I know, you know, maybe some of what's existing may or may not work, but Quincy has been such a guinea pig for prescription drugs. I really don't want him to be a guinea pig for cannabis also. I want him to be using exactly what those other children in Colorado are using.
It certainly sounds like it's almost a group of chemicals that pharmaceuticals. Well, now that's just the trouble. The pharmaceuticals have synthetic marijuana, and you've had some experiences with that, haven't you?
Yes. What happened in the fall was I begged my neurologist. I said, I want my son to be taking what this little girl is taking. I need him to have this cannabis oil. And, like, I don't know if I'm naive or what, but I just thought that my neurologist could just write me a prescription and that he could get this yes. cannabis oil. Well, after about 2 weeks, she gave me a prescription for Marinol, which is synthetic THC. So it's synthetic tetracannabidiol that is made in a lab. And I was just so frustrated because by then, after 2 weeks, I had been doing quite a bit of research on cannabis and, you know, the whole plant of cannabis. If you would find some cannabis growing in the wild, that would have tetracannabidiol. That would also have cannabidiol. It would have a cannabiniol. It would have up to about almost 100 different cannabinoids in the natural plant. And people aren't exactly sure which cannabinoid is effective. So just to get tetracannabidiol, that's actually probably the most psychoactive component of the plant. And my poor baby's had so many psychoactive drugs that it was a big disappointment. But what I did learn is my neurologist cannot write a prescription for medical marijuana. Even in states where it's legal, doctors that are part of the AMA cannot write a prescription for something that is federally Schedule 1 on the DEA schedules of classification. So like Valium, for example, is, I believe, Schedule 2 or Schedule 3, but marijuana federally is considered Schedule 1, which doctors cannot prescribe. So all doctors can do in Illinois and Michigan and Colorado and New Mexico is they can recommend cannabis, and then the patient would then go to another doctor that basically, you know, gives up their AMA standings, and that doctor would write the prescription and approve that patient for cannabis. And in states like New Mexico, where it's very responsible, then that recommendation would then be, it goes to a medical review board where they look at the doctor's recommendation, and then they look at all of the medical records to confirm that a patient does indeed have a diagnosis that would qualify. So there's a system of checks and balances there to make sure that, you know, anybody that just wants to get their hands on cannabis can't. It has to be a valid patient.
Marie, I understand that there is legislation being proposed in Iowa to make medical marijuana legal. Is that true?
Yes, there is. There was a bill introduced in the Senate, and it was declared dead on the same day. But, you know, we patients and parents and advocates never give up hope. I mean, it's, to me, it's not dead until the legislature's completely over. Any leader, from what I understand, can introduce a bill at any time. And I think that the Senate leadership, because it did not have bipartisan sponsorship, did not push it through.
Who proposed the bill?
That was, the sponsors were Senator Bolcom, Senator Matt McCoy, who is my senator, and Senator Courtney. And, you know, immediately, you know, when I contacted Senator Bolcom, he said, contact your own senator, because that's who represents you. So I called my own senator. I didn't even know who my own senator was. I mean, that's how blissfully ignorant I was of politics. But my senator was Matt McCoy, and I called him just ready to argue and ready to debate. And he said to me, you know, medical cannabis has proven effects. It is a no-brainer. Of course I will help you. And so I loved that. I mean, that's a true example of your elected officials going to work for you.
So do you now actively advocate with other legislatures on behalf of keeping this bill alive?
I do. There's a fine line between being an advocate and being a complete pest. So since the legislature had started in January, myself, there's a few other moms, there is a nurse who has post polio syndrome, and there's been a couple of doctors. We have been going up to the Capitol, and some of us as much as three times a week, and pulling out the little pink slips in the rotunda where you can fill out a form and your legislator will come out and talk to you. I have a flyer that is educational, like a two-page flyer, and then we made a form that people can fill out that if they support this. And so I've been printing that out, you know, sorting it and printing it out by legislator's district and just trying to meet with them one-on-one, which is sort of exhausting. Because if you spend the whole day at the Capitol, you might be lucky enough to talk to, you know, on a good day, 6 to 8 senators and representatives.
So that's interesting. You're really engaging in participatory democracy by trying to directly engage your legislators. Can you describe what actually happens when you do that? You go and you fill out a pick slip, and then what happens next?
Sure. So it's free to go down to the Capitol, and it's your right as an Iowan, and you can go down there, and you know, I recommend dressing up and looking good. I think a lot of people don't realize that that makes a difference. And you go to the second floor, and there's a side for the Senate and a side for the House, and there's these wonderful gatekeepers, I call them, and you fill out a form with which senator or representative you want to talk to, and you hand it to the gatekeeper, and then they will go and either find that legislator or their clerk, and then they'll either come back and say, you know, they're not there right now, because they do have a lot of committee meetings that go on throughout the day, or sometimes the legislator just will come right out. And so so I've had legislators come out, and they're just completely surprised that cannabis is medicine, just like I was. And I had one clerk ask me, what website did you read about this? Because not every website is credible. And, you know, I said, well, I went to the NIH website, and I found clinical trials and studies myself. I mean, I really did my homework. And then some of them, you come out, and they say, well, I'm very sympathetic to your situation, but my voters won't go for that. And I think I've gotten that response a little bit from rural legislators. I do appreciate their honesty, but I would like them to poll their voters. And I think if their voters understood that this could save lives also, they might quickly change their minds. I think there's more support out there than a lot of these legislators understand.
Now, there have been some polls. I saw 65% favored. You have any comment on that?
think so. And I think that the news coverage and the coverage from people like yourself to talk about it help people understand that this has been a valid treatment for MS, I think, since before the 1970s. And it was a treatment for epilepsy back in the 40s and even back in the 1800s. But then it got squashed with that reefer madness. I think it was Harry Einslinger, who was in charge of, I guess, the drug czar at the time, was very effective in kind of squashing out any type of cannabis awareness back in the 30s and 40s. So I think that people are understanding that this is medicine, and it's almost like seatbelts. You don't know that you need it until that one time comes where you realize, you know, I need everything available to help protect me.
So on Wednesday, there's going to be an important hearing on this topic. Can you tell us what that is real briefly?
Well, there is a rare part of the Iowa Code, not rare, but it's not very well known. It's section 124.204, where it talks about controlled substances. And that is monitored by the Board of Pharmacy. And there's a part in the Iowa Code that says marijuana is a Schedule I substance, except where provided as rules by the Board of Pharmacy. So if there were rules, marijuana could be a Schedule II substance right now, today. So if you were using marijuana for your cancer to help you out of chemo, for example, it technically could be perfectly legal if there were rules by the Board of Pharmacy. So I asked the Board of Pharmacy, I contacted them initially in October and then finally asked to be on their agenda. And so I was on their agenda in January, and they said that they will give me 60 days to give me an answer. But what I asked them to do was to make rules. I said, please, please, please make rules, because they are really the authority. They understand medicine. They understand the different scheduling and controlled substances much more than legislators do. Legislators never had to say if aspirin was medicine or oxycodone or even Viagra. It was just determined as medicine, and the pharmacy board regulates whether those medicines are allowed in our state.
So, Marie, if somebody would like to contact you, how can they reach you?
Probably the best way, I have an email, cannabisepilepsysurvey@gmail.com, or they're welcome to find me on Facebook. My name is Maria, last name La France. But if somebody tries to friend me, Cressy, maybe send me a message and tell me a little bit about you, because I don't want to just randomly accept any friend request that comes aboard. But
to repeat, Marie, you have a website?
We do have a website. It is called Concerned Iowans for Medical Cannabis.
That's Concerned Iowans for Medical Cannabis.
Yes.
Marie, we have to wrap things up, but I assume that you have an elevator speech because you're doing a lot of talking with senators. You want to give us your 30-second elevator speech before we leave?
You bet. Well, cannabis is medicine proven by clinically placebo-controlled clinical trials for MS, HIV neuropathy, cancer, Crohn's disease, epilepsy, and PTSD, and other conditions. Iowans, if you feel that you should have access to this medication should you get deathly ill, please contact your own legislator. And you can Google Legis, L-E-G-I-S, Iowa, and it would pull up. Or you can even Google Find My Iowa Legislator, and there's a form where you can enter your zip code, and it will tell you who your legislators are and how to get in touch with them. And I would call them and demand politely that they do something this year, because people don't have time to wait.
Well, thank you very much. This has been extremely informative, and we'll get all those websites and other information on our own website for people who will be accessing this program later.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Thanks for joining us, and we'll maybe speak with you later to find out what happened in the next few months down the road.
Thank you so much. Yeah, Wednesday should be a big day. The Board of Pharmacy will have their hearing that day.
Okay, thank you.
Good luck.
Thank you. All right, take care.
In the spirit of including county news in local talk, we have a last-minute announcement from the Boone Community Theater. This Friday, from 6:30 to 9 p.m.,
is Open Mic Night at the Boone Community Theater, 106 South Webster Street in Boone. Bring snacks to share. Bring your dinner, libations, family, and friends. Bring a skit, song, dance, improv, drum, mime, beatbox, poems, stories, whatever your inner soul, heart child needs to express. Bring it.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, and today we've been talking with a number of people. We spoke with the City of Ames manager, Steve Shanker, about a recent Ames City Council decision regarding an application for a grant from the newly formed Reinvestment District Program, and it was regarding 24 acres in the floodplain on 16th Street for building a dinosaur museum, a camp, and Menards home improvement store, motel, and restaurant.
In the last part of our program, we spoke with Maria LaFrance, a woman who is advocating for legalization of medical marijuana. Pat Schlarbaum reported on Robbins. Your hosts today have been Ursula Rudenberg and Susan Franzen. Local Talk was engineered today by Rebecca Brown.
Our theme song for our show is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. And you can also listen to this show and all of past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org, where you'll find an archive for all of the Local Talk shows we've produced since we went on the air in 2012. Recent shows will be posted on our homepage as soon as our webmaster, Ron Carson, can get the information. There you'll find lists of our guests and links to the organization and other resources mentioned on our show. I do want to thank everybody who came out for Ames Trivia Night on Saturday night. It was a fabulous event. We had more than 200 people there, and we had a whole lot of fun and raised some money for community radio. So thank you so much, and see you next year at the next Ames Trivia Night.
If you enjoyed this show, tell your friends and consider becoming one of the 500 families donating $20 per month or $250 per year to help us meet our operating expenses, though we'd appreciate whatever fits into your budget. We'd also like to hear your feedback either by phone at 515-292-2878 or by email khoiradio@gmail.com with news in the subject line.
Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a radio show. If you'd like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 292-2878 or by email at khoiradio@gmail.com. Your participation as the audience is what makes KHOI possible. Thank you for listening, and see you again on the radio.